We finished Perek Chav Zayin. We finished chapter 27 last time. But I'm stuck with a bit of a dilemma because the opening couple of sentences in Perek Chav Ches in chapter 28 really go with chapter 27. On the other hand, we didn't do the review questions from chapter 27 yet, and I sort of feel like with 2 weeks away, or however many weeks we missed because of Chagim, it's probably worthwhile for us to first review chapter 27, even though 28 goes with it. Then go on. I think that probably makes the most sense. So I think that's what we're going to do. I also want to note, I want to thank Josh Mayer, Alina's son, for dedicating learning this afternoon in honor of Alina's birthday. So happy birthday, Alina. I am not going to say the number. And many, many, many more in Simcha and Nachas. Okay. So, if you look at your sheet, you'll see the review questions for the previous chapter are actually the middle, because I put them after the introduction to chapter 28 for the reason that I just mentioned. But thinking back to Perek Chav Zayin, to the start of Perek Chav Zayin, remember that Perek Chav Zayin, chapter 27, came after David's second showdown with right? David had the opportunity to harm Shaul. Shaul was asleep in the military camp. The whole camp was asleep. David went in with Avishai. He refused to harm Shaul. He took his pitcher of water. He took his spear. And then he called out Avner, the general, for not protecting Shaul. He said to Shaul, you know, really, I don't want to hurt you. Look, you know, I've got a track record here of not taking advantage of these opportunities. And at the end of the chapter, Shaul apologizes. Shaul says, I know that you're going to be king. David does not trust that anything is going to change. And so in the beginning of chapter 27, we saw David say, I'm going to run to the land of the Plishtim. So question number one on our list of 10 review questions for chapter 27 is, why doesn't David trust Shaul? Why doesn't he just say, oh, now Shaul gets it. Now Shaul is not going to be after me anymore. So I'm not going to call for responses because it's not fair to people who have been out of this for a few weeks. I'm just going to offer a range of ideas for each of the questions. So the first answer we gave was that Avner, the general, was still hostile to David. And he is, in many ways, the one who is keeping the hostility going between Shaul and David. So therefore, David worries that with the best of intentions on Shaul's part, Avner is still going to keep things going. That's one. Number two, we floated the idea of Ein Somchen Al Hanes. We don't rely on miracles, and so it may be true that Shaul is currently okay with David, but who knows where it's going to go and what kind of vulnerability that would introduce for David. So he says, I'm going to steer clear. Also, we said Shaul has more reasons to be antagonistic now towards David because David has now married more wives. And maybe that's an issue for Shaul, whose daughter Michal is still married to David. And then finally, we said because the last time that David had such a showdown with Shaul in chapter 24, Shaul still came after him afterwards. So why should this be any different? Granted that the apology in chapter 26 was greater. Okay, this is helping people hopefully to remember, you know, the book of Shmuel. Okay, so that was question one. Question number two, though, David says, I'm going to the Plishtim. David was with the Plishtim once before, when he first fled from Shaul, and there David had to pretend to be insane in order to safeguard himself. Why does he think it'll be better this time? So we had a few different answers. One approach was that the king is different now, even though in both places he is identified as Achish. In chapter 27, he actually has a slightly different name. He was identified as, where was it? Achish ben Ma'och. Maybe that was a different Achish. Maybe Achish was just titled for a king, for all we know. And therefore, David thinks it'll be different. Or alternatively, because David is coming in without any disguise at all, and being more open might set things on a different footing, Or because David has 600 men with him, which means that he's less vulnerable. Granted, there are many, many more Philistines. I mean, 600 men isn't going to do much against the Plishtim as a whole, barring a miracle. But still, he appears less vulnerable, and also 600 men are useful. Achish is going to look at him not as just this lone Jew, but rather as the guy with 600 people at his disposal. Last, and probably most important, is the fact that Shaul, the rift between David and Shaul is now well known. Shaul has been coming after David in various places with his whole army or with thousands of men. At a certain point, everybody just knows that things aren't good between David and Shaul, and therefore the Plishtim will. So David goes there. But shortly after he arrives there, we are told that David says to Achish, I don't think I should be in the capital, I should be in one of the Arei HaSadeh, the towns out in the fields. And we wanted to know, why does David want to move out of the capital? So we suggested maybe it's because he wants independent space, maybe it's because he wants room for operations without Achish's oversight. Sandy floated the idea that it could be like Goshen in Egypt. He doesn't want to be living with the Plishtim, with the Philistines. That was an interesting idea. Achish goes along with it. We said in the text, in chapter 27, sentence 7, that David was with the Plishtim for Yamim v'arba'a chodashim. And we weren't clear on what exactly that meant. It was a very strange way to report that period of time. We said it could be it's 4 months and a few days, or it could mean 1 or 2 years and 4 months. We talked a little bit about that. Some of that has to do with how long Shaul's reign was, and I'm not going back into all that math right now. We then saw that David waged war against the Geshuri, the Grizi, or Gizri, the Amaleki, different tribes that lived in the area. And we wanted to know, why does David choose to attack them? And we suggested three possibilities. Either they are enemies of the Jews. So David is taking the opportunity to raid people who are enemies of the Israelites in the land. Or because they were vulnerable people, and David has a goal which we're going to come back to in attacking them. Or because they're actually enemies of the Plishtim, and he's ingratiating himself to Achish by attacking them. So then we asked, why is David attacking anybody? If you take the view that he's attacking them because they're enemies of the Jews, then we understand. It's to help the Jews. If it's that they're enemies of the Plishtim, we understand also, because he wants to get in good with the Plishtim. But if it's just that they're vulnerable, why is he attacking anybody? So we said it could be, this I think was a Barbanel, he needs food in order to survive. He's actually supporting his men off of what he gets from the Plishtim. Or it's in order to pretend he's attacking the Jews. He comes back with spoils, and Achish says to him, where were you today? And he says, I attacked the Jews. And look, here are the spoils from my attack against the Jews. So that may be what he's trying to do. We mentioned that among the people he fights are Amaleki. I don't understand. Shaul destroyed Amalek, all except for Agag, and Shmuel killed Agag. So why in the world are there Amaleki for David to fight here? So we suggested either that Shaul did not succeed in killing everybody. There were those who escaped, an idea we talked about way back in chapter 15. Or there were other Amaleki tribes. There was one tribe that Shaul wiped out, but there were other tribes of Amalek as well. Everyone's good so far? I'm not going too fast? Okay. We then saw, I have to flip the page myself, hang in there. I see why. It wasn't in the text itself. It was something that we talked about. That there was a wife, it's question 8, a wife who might have come to David from his battles in this chapter. Later on, we find out that David has a wife named Ma'acha. And Ma'acha is the daughter of the king of Geshur. And she is the mother of Tamar and of Shalom. So there was an idea that this Ma'acha came to David in his battle against Geshur, and maybe she was an Eshes Yefas Tawar. She was actually a prisoner of war. And that's what the Gemara brings. It affects certain issues in the story of Avshalom that we may get to in Shmuel Beis one day. Next question. When Achish goes to war against the Jews, does he trust David or not? And that really is where we're going in the beginning of chapter 28, is this issue. So I'm going to hold off on question number 9. It really isn't for us yet. But I'm going to jump to question 10, which is, in general, in this chapter, is David acting from a position of weakness or a position of strength? How do we view David's position here in chapter 27? And we saw there were really two different ways to view it. One way to read it is that David is desperate and just doing anything he can in order to escape Shaul, and he lands among the Plishtim. And the other way that we looked at it, the opposite, is that no, David is actually acting with a plan. He is he's coming from strength with his 600 men, doing something which is going to save the Jews and is going to also battle strengthen his ability regarding the Plishtim as well, is what I would say. Clear? We're good? Questions about chapter 27? Okay, then let's go further. Chapter 28, what we're going to end up doing today is we're going to take several minutes on the opening two sentences of chapter 28, which I already mentioned to you, really go with chapter 27. But after that, we're going to spend, I think, the rest of today, realistically, introducing the linchpin of chapter 28, which is the issue of what is called in the Torah an ov. And we have to talk about what an ov is, because it affects everything that happens in the chapter ahead of us. So, let's look at the opening sentences of chapter 28 first, and then we'll do the ov discussion. Vayihi bayamim ha'heim. And it was in those days. Those days meaning when David is living with the Plishtim. Vayikbitzu filishtim es machnehem latzava lihilachem biYisrael. The Plishtim gather their forces to fight the Jews, because that's what Plishtim do, right? I don't know how they worked it out, whether they just had a calendar and, you know, every whatever period of time it said, okay, fight the Jews day. But you know it's been going on throughout Sefer Shmuel. It started in the end of Sefer Shoftim. So the calendar turns and it's time to attack the Jews. Okay, so they gather their forces. Vayomer Achish el David, and Achish says to David, Yadoa teida ki iti teitze b'machane ata va'anashecha. He said, you should know, you and your men are going to go to war with me. You're going to be fighting on my side, at my side, against the Jews. That's what Achish says to David. Vayomer David el Achish, and David says to Achish, Lachen ata seida, eis asher yaseh avdecha, you know what your servant will do. Vayomer Achish el David, and Achish says to David, Lachen shomer l'roshi asimcha kol hayamim. Yeah, I'm going to make you my bodyguard forever. Very cryptic. I see you, Vanessa, shaking your head like, what? What just happened? What did that conversation mean? What did David say to Achish? What did Achish say to David? I don't understand any of it. It's a very hard, it's a hard read, these two sentences. So, fundamentally, I see that you can read this with one approach, that Achish trusts David, but I could also read it the opposite, that Achish does not entirely trust David, and the Plishtim don't necessarily trust David. You could totally read this either way, and in fact, the first approach is Abarbanel's approach. The second approach is Malbim's approach. The earlier commentators, Rashi, they're less clear. But Abarbanel says, Achish trusts David entirely. Achish is saying to David, I want you to fight by my side in battle. And David says, you'll see what I do, which is really vague. Achish assumes that David is saying, I'm going to fight for you and it's going to be awesome. And Achish says, I want you to stay with me, stay nearby as a guard, so that you'll be available to help me in the battle. That's the way Abarbanel reads it. If you take a look at source number one on the sheet, his Va'er Mikol Zeh, it was clarified from all of this, Shagam Ha'umos, Achish Va'anashav, Hayu Ohavim Ma'od David. It wasn't just the Jews who loved David. The Plishtim loved David. Achish loved David. Vayanechsha Beinem L'Sar V'Gadol. They thought he was amazing. They considered him a sar, a noble, an officer, a leader. Vayumakirim Gvurosav U'Ma'asav Aniflaim. They recognized his mighty deeds. They recognized how amazing he was. V'zayah Gam Kein Mipol HaKel Yisbarach V'Chasadav Imo. This was Hashem's doing for David. Kemosha Amar Shlomo, like Shlomo says in Mishlei, Beretzos Hashem Darkei Ish Gam Oivav Yashlimito. When Hashem desires the ways of a person, when Hashem says, ah, this is somebody I like, then his enemies make peace with him as well. So that's the idea according to Abarbanel. Everybody's really happy. Everybody's on the same page. Hashem is looking out for David, and so everybody likes David. That's one approach. I see the hand in that, but I'm just going to give the second approach.
I'm trying to put it down. It's a technical error.
Okay. Just give it time. It'll go down on its own.
Yes, sorry.
Okay. The second approach is Malbim's approach. And Malbim says, no, Achish does not trust David entirely. Or, alternatively, he worries that the Plishtim won't trust David. Take a look at source number two. V'lo ratza she'elech im hachayo. He, Achish, did not want David to go with the soldiers. Basher chashash shelo yirtza lilachem im Yisrael. He's thinking David isn't going to want to fight the Jews. Remember, David could be against Shaul and not want to fight his own brethren. Right? I mean, we know that David actually is loyal to Shaul and doesn't want to fight his brethren. But David certainly could be legitimately against Shaul, but he doesn't want to go fight against the Jews. So Achish thinks to himself, I don't want to put him in that position. Oh, she'yarei she'plishtim lo ya'aminuvo. Or alternatively, Achish is worried that the Plishtim aren't going to trust David. Even if Achish trusts David, who's to say that the Plishtim are going to trust David? And so Achish says, I want you to go with me, and that way you're to be my guard. That's his opening statement to David. David plays dumb, and he says, I don't understand why you're doing that. I'm going to be a great warrior for you. And Achish responds, covering up his lack of faith in David, or his lack of faith in the Plishtim, by saying, no, you're going to be my bodyguard. It's like a consolation prize. You follow? It's like, David, no, you're being with me is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. That's the way that Malbim reads it. So there's going to be a war with the Jews. That war is going to happen in chapter 29. David is going to be, it seems, by the side of the Plishti king. This is a case in which you get a cliffhanger. Because after Pasuk Beis, after sentence two, I would really like to know what's going to happen in this war. Where is David going to go? What is Achish going to do? Is David going to attack the Jews? How is he going to get out of this? However, chapter 28 is going to take us an entirely different route. Chapter 28, instead, if you look at the top of the sheet, is going to give us Shaul's gambit. Because Shaul is panicked. He sees the Plishtim massing to fight. And he says, oh no, now what? And he's going to seek the advice of an Ov. We're going to talk about what an Ov is. He is going to summon Shmuel. Shmuel, of course, has passed away. We know that already from before the story with Naval in chapter 25. But he is going to summon the spirit of Shmuel. Shmuel is going to give him a message. He's going to tell him, yeah, there's a war coming and you're going to lose in a big way. You're going to be joining me. That's what Shmuel is going to say to Shaul, and then we'll see the aftermath of that message and how Shaul responds. That's where this chapter is going. So we're going to leave David on hold, waiting to go to war, while we spend this chapter catching up with Shaul. Okay, questions or comments on what we've said so far?
Just Abarbanel
Yeah.
His viewpoint, the reason that we could believe that Achish trusts David is because everyone knows about the conflict between him and Shaul.
So Abarbanel doesn't say that. It's very interesting. Abarbanel says, even though Abarbanel acknowledges elsewhere that everybody knows about this conflict, when we talked about why David wasn't afraid to go to the Plishtim, that featured in a major way, nonetheless, Abarbanel says it's because Hashem is smoothing the way for him. That's why Achish trusts. It's because Hashem has made sure everybody's going to love David. Which is a theme we've seen, right? We talked about everybody loves David back all the way back in chapter 18. So that's something we're seeing here. Ricky, did you want to say something? No? Okay.
I thought the choice of bodyguard versus servant was really interesting. Because when you talk about someone being a servant, their loyalty to you is such that when you pay them, they show up, and when you dismiss them, they don't. And it also speaks to a greater free agency.
Yes.
Whereas a bodyguard is, for life, is a power play because it is very specific. The person that you are guarding's life is more worthy than the person who's guarding.
True.
And you expect the sacrifice of their life.
It's interesting, yeah.
And so it is a real power play shift. Like, it is a real power play shift. And actually, I actually think the opposite of the previous comment. I think knowing about the relationship between Saul and David could suggest that where there had been professions of great love and great loyalty, similar fact evidence. And so you suggest that, in fact, the great love that was at the beginning and the treachery that was at the end would suggest that someone like David could change.
You're saying treachery to Shaul.
That's right. I mean, treachery to Shaul based upon listening to Hashem. Like, in the sense that you could change what you do, that the oaths of allegiance that you make can change.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, except for the fact that the following sentence is not so clear to me. I believe the world knows that it's Shaul who turned on David and not that David turned on Shaul. Meaning Shaul in very public ways is coming after David. So I'm not sure that it will be viewed as treachery. I do think there's something to be said for David as Shaul's bodyguard and now as Achish's bodyguard. I find that to be very interesting. Yes. Sandra, you've been waiting.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to ask or to clarify something. You said that the Christian didn't become a problem to Israel until the end of Shelter, so just before Shaul. So saying that there was relative peace in the time of Yitzchak, let's say, or Abraham?
So you're asking a very good question, but the answer is going to be a long-winded answer. So the first thing to recognize when we talk about the Plishtim is that we don't know that the group identified as Plishtim in the time of Yitzchak is the same as the group identified as Plishtim in this period, the period of Shmuel. Historians argue that the period the group we call Plishtim in the time of Shimshon, in the time of Shaul, in the time of David, isn't in Israel at the time of Abraham and Yitzchak. They argue that this group, which we know arrived by sea, these were seafaring people who came from the area of Greece and Turkey, they only came in later. Now, there are multiple ways that we could read that in light of the fact that Plishtim are mentioned in the time of Yitzchak. One possibility is these were not a monolithic group. There were waves. Maybe there were people who came in earlier from that area and then this group came in later. Another possibility, we're identifying them based on the location. Plishti means the people who live in the area that ultimately was under Plishti control. We find multiple times in Tanakh that an area will be named for later events. So it could be that the Plishtim of Yitzchak's time are simply a different group that lives in an area that the Torah identifies as Pleshet. So that's a possibility as well. My point in bringing these possibilities and raising it is to say, I don't know whether this is the same group. Now, Chazal, our sages, clearly believe that it is the same group, in the sense that they talk about Abraham making a covenant with Abimelech and his descendants being bound by that not to attack the Plishtim until the Plishtim attack us or until the agreement expires. So they're treating it as though it's the same group. How that works, I can think of different ways to resolve it, but I don't think it's a question that I can really definitively answer. In terms of the quest of the second part of this, you know, that's all about whether this is the same group. The other piece of it is to recognize that the Plishtim really were, so to speak, a third man in this land. The major holders of the land are the Canaanite tribes. They're really a fourth man in, I should say. It's really four. You have the Canaanite tribes who live along the Yarden, primarily the western edge of the Yarden, of the Jordan. You also have the raiders from the desert. Think Amalek, Ammon, Moab, who live east of the Yarden, but frequently cross the Yarden to attack the farmers and shepherds who are living west of the Yarden. We see that throughout Shoftim. You have the Jews, and we're at odds with both of those groups. And then you have the Plishtim. And the Plishtim, having invaded from the north and west, coming in from the Mediterranean, are also trying to secure territory. They're battling us, and they're also battling Canaan. I think I mentioned in a shiur a long time ago that the Plishtim, in essence, are not our opposites, but in certain ways you can call them our opposites, in the sense that they did successfully what we were supposed to do. They come into the land, they fight the Canaanim, they get a hold of the land, which becomes identified as theirs. Everybody knows the area of Gaza is Plishti land. Whereas the Jews come in, and instead of battling the Canaanim, they start to live among the Canaanim. And there's that whole trend that you see where initially they're not able to conquer, and then they choose not to conquer. They make covenants with the people around them, and before you know it, they're living in Canaanite lands and under Canaanite control. So the Plishtim do what the Jews were supposed to do. But all of this brings me back to answer your question and to say it's entirely possible that in the intervening period from the time when the Jews are first entering the land and fighting the Canaanim until the time of Shimshon, a period of a few centuries, the Plishtim could be in decline. They're not as powerful at that point, and it's only after that that they start to become greater again. That does happen. You're dealing with multiple forces. You're dealing with the raiders from the east. You're dealing with the Canaanim. You're dealing with the Plishtim. So when one is up, another is down. That happens. I hope that helps clarify something.
Very much so. Thank you.
Oh, good. Okay, Claudette, you were going to say?
I was just going to say, talk about the relationship between Achish and David. It seems that that relationship was more on a personal level, because if you're going to ask somebody to be your bodyguard, that means that you really trust that person. But it's not a relationship where I think Achish expected David to go against the Israelites. I don't think it's about the Plishtim and the Israelites. I think it's about the personal friendship.
See, it's interesting, because I saw the note in the chat from Leah who said Achish wanted to keep his friend close and his enemy closer, which suggests that making him the bodyguard is a function of lack of trust, right, along the lines of Malbin, perhaps. But on the other hand, as you point out, Claudette, you know, a bodyguard has access, aside from the point that Nanette made, that the bodyguard is expected to put down his own life to protect the person he's guarding. But the bodyguard, in a time of war, when anything can happen, is able to do whatever he wants. And so I think you're right. I think there's, you know, this could be read, as Abarbanel does, as a demonstration of trust. It's two ways you could look at it, and I can't say which one is correct. Okay.
And also, there is a cryptic statement that when he said to Akish, you know what I'm going to do. I think Akish realized he had a friend because he knew that David would not go against his people.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. It's really a solid maybe. That's what I would say. Okay. So let's talk about Ov. This is an incredibly difficult thing to figure out, but we're going to do the best that we can. And I think with half an hour, we should be able to come up with something. So what we know walking into this is that Ov is some form of necromancy. Okay, the idea of communicating with someone who has passed away. That's very clear from the ways that the Torah presents it. If you don't have a Tanakh with you, I would suggest either getting one or finding one on your computer. It's going to be helpful. I gave you references to a whole bunch of psukim, a whole bunch of verses on the sheet, as you'll see if you look at sources 5 to 8. And it's worth it to be able to see some of them. So the problems with understanding the Ov include, number one, mechanics. In the sense that the Torah is going to use multiple terms for necromancy. It's going to use the term Ov. It's going to use the term Yid Oni, which seems to also be something involving communication with the deceased. And Doresh El Hametim, which means seeking something from the dead. But the Torah never presents how any of these are done. So how are they distinct from each other? I mean, I would have assumed Doresh El Hametim is a catch-all. Using anything to seek something of the dead. But the Torah lists them separately, suggesting there is something to distinguish them, but I don't know what. Another mechanics issue is that the word Ov doesn't have much to explain it in the Torah. We're going to go through the different places where the word Ov appears. It's very unclear. Secular scholars do not have a clear view of what this practice was or of the etymology of the word Ov. They just say it's some form of necromancy. I read a bunch of articles which basically all come down to, yeah, I don't know. Don't know what the word means, don't know what they were doing. Note, though, the vagueness of it is not strange. Because if this was an idolatrous practice, I wouldn't really expect to find Tanakh giving me a how-to. Right? This is one thing you're not supposed to do. I'm not going to give you a step-by-step. But it's challenging just in terms of, you know, technical mechanics. And then it's difficult because philosophically it's difficult. The Torah is very, very clear in believing that something happens after a body dies. I'm well aware that there are circles where they think that the Torah does not believe it and that it only comes into Judaism later. But I think that people who say that are deluded. I gave a 6-part shiur on this at Beth Emeth. Some of you were there in basically this time of year in 2019 before the roof fell in on society. And there I quoted for you. First of all, if you take a look at source number 3, that's a link where you can find the recordings from that series. It was a fun series. But in source number 4, I bring you from Professor Alan Siegel. Professor Alan Siegel is an Ivy League professor. He taught at Princeton, at Columbia, I think Harvard also. He did a stint at U of T, slumming a little bit. And he talks a lot about religion in the ancient Near East. And this is from his book, Life After Death, A History of the Afterlife and the Religions of the West. Rabbi Karapkin showed me this at one point, this book. I think he used it in a shiur I was at. So look at what Siegel has to say. He says, that the Bible lacks a concrete narrative of the afterlife. The fact that the Torah does not say, here's what happens, this and then this and then this, as we have seen so often manifested in the pagan cultures around it, the cultures around us did have that, must, we suspect, not be just accidental or deficient. It must be part of the biblical polemic against its environment. In contrast to the plethora of different ideas about life after death in the great river cultures surrounding Israel, early Bible traditions seem uninterested in the notion of an afterlife. Practically every scholar who systematically surveys the oldest sections of the biblical text is impressed with the lack of a beatific notion of the hereafter for anyone. It doesn't tell us, you go to Gan Eden and it's like Valhalla or what, like, it's just not there. But that is not all that is missing. Virtually the entire mythological framework of cosmological discussion in the ancient world is lacking, and the traces that remain are transformed. What he's trying to say there, because this isn't the focus for today, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, what he's trying to say is, in all these other societies, they talk about the god of the rain and the god of this and the god of that. That's all transformed. Everything, rain and dew, crops, increase of flocks, historical events as well, is due to the Lord, the God of Israel. Gone is the exuberant pantheon of exalted, loving, quarreling, and warring gods. Turn the page. It could be that Hebrew culture foresaw no significant afterlife for the dead, that the covenant had nothing to say about the afterlife except to warn against believing that another god could supply one. Maybe you'll make the argument that the Bible doesn't believe in having an afterlife. But he says that belief would make the Hebrews absolutely unique among world cultures, and especially strange in the ancient Near East, where elaborate ideas about post-mortem existence and even more elaborate rituals were everywhere part of literature, myth, and social life. You're going to argue that the Jews were the only inhabitants of the ancient Near East who didn't believe in it. Aside from the evidence in the biblical text for it, it's like, why? We are not only faced with a huge silence in terms of the details, we are left without conclusive evidence for a sure explanation. How could the Bible have avoided discussing this issue? Since the reasons for the lack of information are obscure, the Bible presents us with the scholarly predicament of a classic argument from silence. You're trying to explain why it doesn't say something. The best we can offer is speculation, based on what clues we can find in the text and in archaeological records. We know that the Bible's dislike of foreign cults and gods, other than, he uses the four-letter name of Hashem that I'm not going to put on the page, demythologized all the gods, turning them into created objects. Presumably, any extended discussion of life after death with the realm of the dead with its pantheon of divinities would open the door for idolatry or veneration of ghosts, which the Bible in its final and present form has entirely forbidden. So Siegel's argument is that the Torah does not want to spend time talking about this because it doesn't want to encourage the cults of gods and afterlife that are found in other cultures. Better to just leave it. There are other answers for why the Torah doesn't discuss it. Again, go back to the that link that I gave you in the previous source, and you'll get a fuller discussion. But the Torah is quiet about the specifics. It tells us about something called Sheol, that it's there, but I don't know what Sheol is. It talks about people trying to communicate with the dead, but it doesn't tell us anything about how it's done. We don't even know whether communicating with the dead is worthwhile, except that the Torah says don't do it. The Torah prohibits forms of necromancy with a death penalty for the Ov, or the Yid-Oni, the one who actually tries to speak to the dead, to communicate in this way, is subject to a death penalty. Those who approach them is different. Jeanette, I see what you wrote. Who is he referring to as the Bible? I think he means the Chumash. I think he's referring to the Chumash. Are you having trouble unmuting? I'm going to see if I can help you here. I'm going to send you a request to unmute. If you click that, it will work. Don't know. The Torah has this very severe.
Sorry, I figured it out. I'm just like, it's almost like he doesn't talk like God. You know, when we talk about the Torah,
no, he's not
talking about the Bible. You know, who does he think?
He's an academic professor. He's not coming at this from a religious perspective.
That's why I'm asking it. I'm asking, what does he think he means? Like a book doesn't write. Who is he saying?
So I don't know Alan Siegel's religious beliefs, so I couldn't answer you, but I believe he's writing from a... I believe he's writing from an academic's perspective. He's coming at this from a secular approach that the Bible was a culture's product.
Okay.
Which I think makes his point more credible. The
yes.
fact that he's not coming at it because he believes in something and, you know, he's coming at it from a secular perspective. So the Torah says we're not allowed to engage in this necromancy. And it gives us this penalty for it, a very severe penalty. So what is this, and what is so bad about engaging in it? Now, let me just be clear about the discussion that we're having for the next 20 minutes or so. We're not discussing what happened in this chapter. Meaning, I'm asking more broadly about how Ov works. How it happened in this chapter is going to pose unique challenges. So we're going to try to avoid that to the extent we can. We won't be able to entirely, but somewhat. So if you look on your sheet at source number 5, I gave you links in number 5 to psukim found in the Torah, Parshas Kedoshim, and then again in Sefer Devarim, where the Torah says very clearly that we are not supposed to consult with an oath. If you look at the reference in Vayikra chapter 19, which I am just flipping to here. So if you look at the reference there, this is when the Torah says that you should avoid a whole bunch of practices. Some of them are about immorality. Some of them, you know, tattoos may have been tied to pagan cultures around us, very unclear. And it says, don't turn to the ovot. Ovot is plural of ov. Don't turn to the yid-onim. We know nothing about them right now. Don't seek to make yourself tamei with them. Tamei is the term that we often use for impurity. I am Hashem, your God. Very, very unclear as to what's involved. Ricky, I see your hand, but I'm going through the section first. Then you jump to chapter 20, still in the same section, still in the same parsha, and you get more detail. Sentences 23 to 27 warn, do not walk in the ways of the nations that I am getting rid of before you in Canaan. I am giving you their land. I don't want you to imitate their mistakes. And when it talks about those mistakes, the last sentence in that section says, Ov and Yidoni. So this is some kind of Canaanite practice that we're being warned not to emulate. But the fuller description and the fuller context is seen when you go to Devarim chapter 18. In Devarim chapter 18, I'm just turning to it myself, in Parsha Shoftim, so here we get our warnings to the Jews about what their conduct should be when they enter the land. And one of the things that Hashem tells us is don't do, again, like the practices of those nations. Don't pass your children through fire, right? The Molech idolatry. Don't engage in sorcery, calculation of special times and omens and sorcery. Don't try to charm animals, which was also a form of sorcery, and requesting of the Ov and the Yidoni and seeking the dead. And all of these, we are told, are things that are abhorrent to God. Stay away from all of those things. And that starts to make the picture a little more clear. First of all, because we're now linking Ov with seeking the dead, and because we're associated with something that sounds like it may be idolatry, which is very important and we're going to come back to. After that, the Torah is silent about it. We go through Yoshua, there's nothing. We go through Shoftim, there's nothing. Then you get to our chapter. And you find Shaul, in the beginning of the chapter, we're told he tries to get rid of the ovot. Clearly, he was not successful because there's an oath. And he finds her, and he uses her to try to consult Shmuel. Two other texts that will succeed in confusing us. Oh, I'm sorry, in source number 6, I forgot to mention. We're not going to look it up now, but if you want to, I gave you the references in Malachim and Divrei Hayamim. King Menashe. Menashe is the successor of Chizkiyahu. And he is guilty of many things, one of which is idolatry, popularizing idolatry. And one of the things that he supports is, sure enough, the Ov practice. So it shows up in the time of Menashe in the book of Malachim. And then two last texts. Yeshaya chapter 29, sentence 4. Not directly talking about Ov at all. Chapter 29 in Yeshaya sentence 4 is part of a section where he's talking about the coming downfall of various enemies of Israel. But here he's actually addressing Israel itself. Actually, no, I'm sorry. That section with the enemies ends in chapter 23. This is after that. He's simply talking to the Jews. And he says there in chapter 29, sentence 4, you will be low. He says, Veshafalta may eretz tedaberi. You will speak from the ground. May afar from the dust. He says, V'haya ke'ov may eretz kolech. Your voice will be like an ov coming forth from the ground. Fits with the idea that ov refers to communication from the dead. The last reference is all the way in Eov, in Job, in the Ksuvim, in the writings. Chapter 32, sentence 19. This is the speech of Elihu. And Elihu says, out of nowhere, he's talking about how he's fed up listening to Eov. He's filled with all of his words. And he says, I'm filled with my own words. He says in sentence 18, Malesi milim, I'm filled with words. Hinei bitni, my belly is kiyayin lo yipaseach, like unopened wine, ke'ovos chadashim yibakeya, it will split like new ovot. Unclear what that has to do with anything. It seems like it means barrels just from the context. And most commentators say it's not about our ov, but even Ezra says no, it certainly is. He says, the practice of Ov is empty, like a new barrel. And that's the connection that he sees, which is interesting. But basically, from the biblical text, what emerges is something involving communication, something that may be idolatrous, something involving potentially a voice from the ground. That's the, that's what we have here. Yes, Ricky.
I'm trying to follow. At some point you say the Ov is a practice, and at some point the Ov, you say consulting with the Ov and all that. So which is, right. Is it a person that does that practice, or is it the practice itself?
Good question. So the answer is that the Ov is the term that we use for the person. Sometimes they're called a Baalat Ov, you'll see in this chapter, or a Baal Ov, presumably. And the person who inquires is really the Shoel Ov, one who asks of an Ov. But we don't have, the problem is we don't have a term in Hebrew for the practice. What you usually find when rabbis write about it in their commentaries is Maaseh Ov, the deed of an Ov. But it's really the person who is the Ov.
So it's not done on a personal level where I am trying to communicate.
No, you got to go to a professional. You can't just
do it. I
didn't
know that.
Yeah, you have to go on Jiffy and look for an Ov. Don't do that. Don't, if there is one on Jiffy, don't use them. Okay, Claudette.
I just find Professor Alan Siegel's statements interesting, because if I think about what the ancient writers of the narrative, I think they were trying to focus
Right? So that is one of the approaches that's brought to explain why Hashem chooses to de-emphasize the afterlife. The only thing that I'm going to note is that, Professor Siegel may believe that they're ancient writers. I'm not okay with that. To me, it's writer with a capital W. But yes, that is one of the approaches that is brought. So, okay, I now have a thoroughly unclear biblical text telling me about oath. What is it? What is the oath doing? So the Gemara gives us a little bit of detail. Take a look at source number 9. Gemara in Sanhedrin. Tana Rabbanan, our sages taught. Baal Ov, Zeha Medaber Bein HaPrakim Umi Bein Atzilei Yadav. Someone who speaks from between the joints and between the joints of the arms. What this is going to mean, you'll see, is the armpit. I'm speaking here to a group of women, but like it's like boys in high school. That's what this is. Not exactly.
Sorry, I didn't understand it.
That's okay. I'm gonna let that one go. That's what the ov does according to the Gemara. Yidoni zeh meiniach etzem yadoa b'fiv v'humadaber me'elav. Yidoni is somebody who puts the bone of something called a yedoa in his mouth, and it speaks on its own. There's always a temptation when reading this line in the Gemara to read it as etzem yadua, a known bone. Like, there's a particular bone that they know. But that's not what it is. It is the bone of a creature called a yedoa. We're going to come back to that. But that's what a yidoni uses. Yidoni uses the yedoa bone. And then you get Tanu Rabbanan, a brisa that says, Baal Ov Echad Hamale Bizchuro VeEchad HaNishal BeGulgoles. Baal Ov includes somebody who raises the ghost or whatever it is, Bizchuro, we might come back to that word in a little bit, or one who asks of a skull, inquires of the skull. That's what you're getting here in the Gemara. So you get a little bit more. The Rambam, Maimonides, in source number 10, gives you a lot more. In the interest of time, I see it's 2:23, so I'm just going to read out my English translation. What is an ov act? What is ma'asei ov? One who stands and burns a known incense, and holds a myrtle branch in his hand and waves it, and speaks words that they know in a low voice, there's a particular chant, until the questioner hears as though one is speaking to him and responding to his questions from beneath the earth, right, there's that Yeshaya pasuk, from beneath the earth, in a very low voice, as though it is not audible, but only sensed. That's one practice. Also, one who takes a skull of the dead and burns incense to it, performs sorcery with it, until it is heard as though a voice emerged from his armpit, very low, answering him. All of these are ov acts. This is all ov. One who does these receives skila. The Ravid, classic commentator on the Rambam, says, one does this in a cemetery, and with the skin of a corpse, speaking from the corpse's armpit. It's not your armpit that's speaking, it's the corpse's armpit that's speaking. Which now I understand entirely. Then he goes on with, what is a yidoni? Places a bone of a bird called yidoa in his mouth, and burns incense and performs other acts until he falls as one experiencing a seizure. And he speaks of future events. All of these are types of idolatry. Rambam is not a fan, which you'll be shocked, I know, to find out. Rabbi Yosef Albo, in his Sefer HaIkarim, some of you learned about Rabbi Albo with me a couple of years ago in the Wednesday morning classes. So he offers additional information in the name of Ramban. Very interesting. Again, I'm going to skip the Hebrew, just do my English translation. Ricky, what you're writing about in Victorian times is long after this, what they're describing. So he says, and some perform burnings and incense to join with the dead. They sleep in the cemetery so that the spirit of Tum'ah from the dead will rest on them, to the point where they bury their dead in their houses of idolatry, and men and women gather there and stand by the graves and pray over them. And because of this, the spirit of Tum'ah from the dead rests on them or on their priests and tells them of future events which will befall them soon, as Ramban wrote in his drasha that he received from those who know the Ov actions. And he also wrote that this remained with Christians, burying their dead in their house of worship and praying together, men and women, and they make noises when burying their dead because those nations to Christianity retained their ancestral actions as they retain the practices of fire worship, making great bonfires on one night when the sun enters the mazel of Cancer. I feel like this is totally like Halloween territory at this point, which is very appropriate. I saw the note, Ruth, about the Golem of Prague, but that's a very, very different issue. It's a whole other issue. A problematic one for sure, but a whole other issue. So the idea here is some kind of practice of summoning the dead, you know, something along those lines. It appears to me like this is a collection of practices. I think that's where Rambam is going with it. The Maharal of Prague, who you just mentioned in terms of the golem, but the Maharal notes that that there's actually a bit of a challenge. I'm trying to figure out how to say delicately. Earlier, we noted the Gemara in source number 9, which talked about the Ov as being raised bizichuro. So the Rashi there comments that it's an act involving male genitalia. That's what is going on in that Gemara. And Tosfos is bothered, because Tosfos says the Ov in our story is female. How are you going to explain that? So the Maharal of Prague says the answer clearly is that there are multiple practices under the heading of Ov. Now, that doesn't really work so well, because at the end of the day, there has to be something that's called Ov and something called Yid Oni. Why did you consider them separate? And why is Doreshel HaMeitim, seeking the dead, separate? There's a lot more we need to understand as we read this, and we don't. We just flat out don't. Ricky, I see your question about how frequent using the Ov was. And the answer is, I don't know, except two things I can tell you. Number one, it completely vanishes in Navi from the time that the Torah prohibits it in Parsha Shoftim all the way until now. And you weren't there the whole time, but we, this group, learned Yoshua together, Shoftim together. We spanned centuries, and we never ever saw anything about an Ov. And you won't see it again after this until Menashe, who is, you know, great-great-grandson or so of Shlomo. Like, you've got a long period of time where there's zero mention of it. On the other hand, hang in there, Ricky. On the other hand, in the beginning of the chapter, we are going to find out that Shaul launched a campaign to get rid of them. So they must have been there. So I don't know how to answer you, except to say they didn't rise to the level of being mentioned in Tanakh, but they very clearly were around. That's what I can say. So we didn't get to yet two big questions. Number one, is Ov real? Right? Is it effective? Meaning, do you say Ov is a joke, and yet God says, I don't want you to do it? Or is it a thing? Like, you could actually communicate with the dead in this method, and God doesn't want you to do that. That's one question we have to address. And the other question is, why is the Torah prohibiting this and with such harsh penalties? What's wrong with wanting to know what's going to happen in the future? Why does this bother us so much? And I'm sure based on what we've said so far, you definitely have ideas. But what I want to do is, in the beginning of the week, next week, I want to spend some time on this question of, is this thing real? Because that's going to affect how we understand the events of our chapter, as well as the question of why the Torah prohibits it. And then we'll go through the story and find out, so was this real within our chapter or was it not? And you will be stunned to find out that not everybody agrees. So, God willing, back here next week to continue the conversation. Be well.
Have a good Shabbos. Thank you.
Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you.